45. The story about Reality Check stayed hot until it didn't. The mob of reporters thinned, then vanished. The PR firm's tallies of stories in print and on the air, neatly divided into favorable, unfavorable, and mixed content, lessened in number. Camera drones, which had zoomed overhead, dwindled but did not disappear completely. Those remaining were mostly from curiosity seekers, not press. The PR people called only rarely, and then the calls came from assistants to assistants. But online, the compound was not only debated and reviled, but also threatened. Julian called together senior medical and software staff. Standing in front of an oversized computer screen in Wing 3, he said, "The FBI called this morning. Agent Kaplow sent me posts the Bureau is monitoring across various platforms. I want you all to see a sampling. You have the right to know this." The screen brightened. "At Reality Check Must Die. You don't have much time now, suckers. At Reality Check Must Die. Soon. And the infidels will die in blood and fire. Believe it. At Reality Check Must Die. Those two so-called doctors who put chips in head, it's mind control. At Reality Check Must Die. Fuck all of them. At Reality Check Must Die. Soon now. Real soon. At Reality Check Must Die. That so-called physicist is the Antichrist." Molly blurted, "Those fuckers!" Barbara, visibly shaken, said, "What is the FBI doing about these?" Julian said, "All Agent Kaplow would tell me is that they're working on it." Caro said, "As most of you know, I've been through online threats before at Fairley Memorial, but nobody ever physically attacked me or anything close to it. It was awful, but nothing ever went beyond talk." "That's what everyone hopes. If I hear more from the FBI, I'll let you know. Meanwhile, I want everyone to stay under the walkway eaves when you move around inside the compound. Do not leave the compound without first discussing it with me. Caro, inform the rest of the medical staff of that. Aiden, do the same with the software techs. I'll talk to James. But first, you need to see one more thing. A video. This was taken by the upward-facing security camera on the north wall just after dawn." Empty blue sky. Then a drone traversed the screen and exited at the left. Julian said, "The FBI enlarged the image to examine the drone. It wasn't launched by some curious amateur. It's an older model of military-grade surveillance drone, which can be purchased on the black market." No one spoke until Caro said, "If you didn't expect this, then why is there a surveillance camera pointing upward at the sky?" Julian gazed at her. Finally, he said, "Because what you don't expect is often what gets you." Then, all at once, the reporters were back, along with phone calls and press drones overhead, and camera crews stalking around the building, shooting what had to be dull footage of windowless walls. Especially aggressive news people pounded on the front gate. They interviewed bewildered delivery truck drivers unloading supplies on the loading dock. Caro and Trevor cornered a frayed-looking Julian, shouting into a phone in the security office, "You said the investigation was undercover!" He listened, looking angrier every moment. Ivan and Sophie sat monitoring screens. Trevor said to Sophie, "What happened? Why are those reporters back?" "The New York Times printed an article about the FBI investigation of Alternate Mayhem. Somehow the paper found out that the FBI tied Alternate Mayhem to Ben Clarby and to his murder, and so to us." Julian shouted into his phone, "And if the Bureau security is so bad, why would we trust you with ours? That leak came from you. We don't want more publicity. You goddamn know that." Trevor said, "That other phone is ringing." Ivan picked up, just as tech reinforcements arrived noisily in the crowded office and slid out of his seat. He wedged himself into a corner of the room, uncharacteristically silent as he strained to hear. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'll get him. Julian, you gotta take this. Julian punched viciously at his own phone, ending the FBI call. Not now. No, you really gotta, Ivan said. It's the PR woman. I said not now. Nothing daunted Ivan, immune to social cues even when they tried to punch him in the solar plexus. No, now. She says your best chance is a high-profile attack, and she thinks she can get you 60 minutes after all if you... Julian grabbed Ivan's phone. Instantly, his voice was controlled, polished, even silky. Deanna, this is Julian. I'm glad to hear from you. Caro's eyes widened. How did he transform himself so completely, so fast? Trevor said quietly to Ivan, If what? Ivan looked confused. Trevor said patiently, You told Julian that Deanna said she can get us 60 minutes to explain this mess. If what? Oh, Ivan said, as if it were trivial. If we can implant a really important person who's not connected with the project in any way, and who everybody has already heard of and will be impressed by. I don't know who she meant. The president, maybe? Aiden had arrived. Ivan, he said. There's a code glitch you need to help code with. He's waiting in Wing 3. Go. I'll see that your shift is covered here. Ivan's eyes lit up. A code glitch? He raced off. Julian finished on the phone. His third expression, following utter fury and genial business mode, reminded Caro of a wolf focused on prey. We need a high-profile, trusted, impressive volunteer to be implanted, undergo a filmed session, and go on 60 Minutes to give a totally objective report on what we're doing here. And it needs to happen in the next week. That's the only way 60 Minutes will give us an interview and so the chance to clear the project's name on national TV. I don't know anybody to ask. Caro, I know you don't. And Trevor, you've spent the last years in jungles. That leaves George. I don't think another physicist will do, but if George has British or American political connections from his Oxford days who are curious enough about his theory, although they'd have to be really aged, so maybe... Trevor said, I might know someone. The woman who arrived by helicopter, at the compound, was not what Weigert expected. She was not a young journalist. Weigert had vaguely visualized someone like Woodward or Bernstein breaking the Watergate scandal, a feat of reporting that had greatly impressed George as a young man. After Trevor Abruzzo said that Stephanie Kathleen O'Malley would let herself be implanted, and 60 Minutes had agreed to do the show if it included Ms. O'Malley's reporting, Weigert read her Associated Press series about Médecins Sans Frontières doctors in the Congo. The series had not only surprised, but also shocked him. She'd written about the doctors as if they were criminals. Well, no, not that. She described the wonderful medical work they did, the lives they saved, the risks they took for their patients. But she also reported bribery of government officials, pilfering of supplies, heavy drinking, drug use, wild sex. Weigert had had no idea. It was not Florence Nightingale. Had Trevor Abruzzo? Weigert didn't want to know. He liked Trevor. Weigert joined Julian, Caroline, and Trevor to meet the journalist at the front gate. Ms. O'Malley looked what Rose would have called a hard 50, with sun-damaged skin, muscled arms, and short reddish hair that blew wildly in the wind from the helicopter blades. She wore a t-shirt and shorts with a dozen pockets. Her eyes, in a snub-nosed, sharp-chinned face, were a startling blue, as vivid as Julian's, and, to Weigert, just as theatrical. He'd gotten used to Julian's flashy looks, but he didn't think he'd ever get used to this woman. Everything about her seemed alien to him. Her aggressive stance, her twangy voice, the battered canvas duffel bag that was her only luggage. And why was there a small scorched hole in it? Also, her history. She'd written about murderers, heroin dealers, the IRA, dictators, sometimes risking her life to live with them for a while. She made Weigert feel provincial. "Hey, mate," she said, hugging Trevor. Mate? But she wasn't Australian, was she? Weigert was sure she wasn't. Trevor laughed and hugged her back. So it was some sort of joke between them. When it was Weigert's turn to be introduced, he said, "Welcome, Ms. O'Malley. I'll call me Sepp." Yes, well, Sepp. He was not going to do that. "I'll be orienting you to the science behind the project and how we've applied it to..."
"I read your book. I don't need orienting, and I'm on board with the surgery. Hey, the worst it can do is kill me, right?"
Trevor grinned. Another old joke? Evidently. Caroline said, a little stiffly, "I'll try to avoid that." Ms. O'Malley said,
"I have complete confidence in you, Caro. When do I go under your knife? Trev, you'll be there, right?"
"I'll be assisting."
"Just like old times. You assisting that old drunk Johan Lundberg."
Weigert frowned. Why was an old drunk performing surgery? And Trevor would be assisting Caroline, who was hardly an old drunk. Had Julian made a mistake, trusting the reputation of their project to the reactions of this strange, intelligent, combative woman? Even though her work seemed to be acclaimed and noticed everywhere, how could one even tell anymore? Stephanie O'Malley had a surprisingly strong grasp of Weigert's theory and the science that supported it. A layperson's grasp, of course, but accurate as far as it went. Her curiosity seemed genuine and her questions shrewd. If she hadn't smoked throughout the entire hour-long interview, which Weigert insisted be outside at a picnic bench in the Wing 1 courtyard, he might have even enjoyed talking to her. He tried to sit upwind of her smoke, but there was no wind. She noticed his discomfort. She seemed to notice everything.
"Bad habit, I know. But in Africa and Afghanistan, everybody smokes. Helps with the tension."
"Doctors chew? Medical doctors were smoking?" She grinned at him, and Weigert was sharply reminded of the indulgent smile that Rose sometimes gave him. Not that this woman was anything like his wife. She was, in fact, Rose's complete opposite. She said,
"You should at least give me credit for reining in my profanity. Another tension reliever in the middle of war."
He said primly, "Trevor was there, and he doesn't use profanity." That smile again. She ground out her cigarette in the saucer of her coffee cup.
"Not here, anyway."
Weigert was glad that Ms. O'Malley seemed like a fair and intelligent journalist, and even gladder that the interview was over.